So, for today, I'm going to talk about mental noting. Last week, it came up in the discussion, and it seemed like it might be a good idea to talk about this very useful technique that's used in some schools of Vipassana, of mindfulness, which is sometimes called mental noting, sometimes called labeling. And it's very big in as a technique in the particular lineage of Vipassana that I trained in Asia, and which Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack and various people trained in. And they came and brought this technique with them as they brought the mindfulness practice here to the West. It's a very powerful technique, but it is a technique. And techniques should always be used with care and with respect, and ready perhaps to understand their shortcomings or the problems in using them, and being wise about how they're used and how to drop them when the appropriate time comes to drop them. It's not necessary to use mental noting as part of Vipassana. And in fact, some Vipassana teachers in the wider Theravadan tradition, I've heard, can be quite critical of the practice of mental noting. They think it doesn't work. They think it just makes people uptight to do it. And they get kind of, often, you know, when people leave one school of meditation, sometimes they go because it didn't quite work for them. And so they go to another school of meditation and they tell the teachers there, oh, how it didn't work for them. And then they generalize, oh, it doesn't work, that meditation, for people. And, it didn't work for them. It doesn't mean it doesn't work for other people. So mental noting doesn't work, or our way of practicing doesn't work for some people, and that's quite fine. I don't think it's to be expected it should work for everybody. But you do hear some teachers who are quite critical of this. And you also hear, I've heard individual practitioners who are quite critical of it. They're in a scene even, that they have various philosophies or views or attempts to do it, which it doesn't quite work for them, or they don't like it. So I'd like to talk about it today, and I'd like to try to make it come alive for you if I can, and give you a little bit of sense of its value. And even if you don't want to do it, perhaps you'll find greater appreciation of how useful it might be for some people, or maybe some understanding of when it's useful. Maybe for you it'll be useful in some circumstances, but not at all. In the Zen tradition, they have a saying that words can kill and words can give birth. They can give life and they can give death. And so it's kind of dramatic language about the power of words. And certainly what we say to our friends and our neighbors can have big impacts, and we can crush someone's spirits by what we say, or we can elevate them and bring them up and revive people. There are words that heal and there are words that hurt. And we can maybe say bring life and kill. But that kind of dichotomy, that words can do both things, along that is very important to keep in mind. So we don't settle on, oh, it's only one way. Words are only bring life or they only kill. But actually in different circumstances, they can do either one. And in Zen practice, you actually learn how to recognize both. You recognize the problems of words and you recognize the great opportunity. And in fact, in some sense, the Zen tradition is an extremely verbal tradition. They pride themselves for burning the scriptures. And then they went and wrote a whole big corpus that's even bigger that they don't call scriptures. But words and playing with words, understanding words. And actually, if you go become a serious Zen student, especially in the koan system, in the Rinzai system in Japan, it's very, I know it's hard, but the people who really go into it, and Japanese monks who really go deep into that koan system, have to study Chinese literature in order to do it. So you have this idea of Zen as being, you know, doing away with words and books and just going right to the heart of the matter. And you go to the monasteries in Japan, you have to study Chinese literature and folklore and all this stuff in order to kind of really understand what the words of these Zen stories say. It's a very literary tradition in some ways from one perspective. So here's a quote about that for me indicates how powerful naming can be. Giving words to things, discovering the power of language. Maybe some of you know this from Helen Keller's autobiography. So Helen Keller, for those of you who might not be from the West or something, don't know the history, was a woman who was born deaf and dumb. She couldn't, right? Blind and deaf, right? But
she wasn't born that way.
Wasn't born.
She had a very high fever.
Yeah.
Original framework was like that,
yeah. And it was taken away. I see. So she couldn't see and she couldn't hear.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So for those people who didn't grow up in the West, they need to be told these things. And I wasn't born in America. My wife is amazed at me sometimes at the things I don't know. So here's Helen Keller writing. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over my hand, she spelled into the other the word water. First slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as something forgotten, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened in my soul, gave it light, hope, set it free. So that's pretty powerful about the words giving life. I mean, imagine if you don't have any words at all to be able to communicate. My 14-month-old baby now is beginning to communicate quite a bit, but it's mostly through grunting and or whining. And it's quite phenomenal how much you can communicate that way and how much you can get your way in the world. So he's already learning to communicate. And my wife's trying to teach him sign language, which he's learning a little bit sign language. And today she was very proud of him because he used sign language to clearly indicate he wanted his diaper changed. And that's very nice because otherwise you're guessing and wondering why they're, you know, what's going on. And if he wants more, he goes, puts his hands together like this. And so it's signs. Words are a way of getting, manipulating the world. Or participating in the world or finding your way. So they're really important. And then you have kind of the other end of the spectrum. By the time we maybe become really adept at words and using words, then there's the other side of words where they can kill or where they can kind of diminish life in some way. And so here's a passage from Rachel Naomi Remen's book, Kitchen Table Wisdom. And she, in this passage at least, in this context, is very critical of labels. A label is a mask life wears. So rather than a label giving life to life, giving birth to something, it's something which covers it over. We put labels on life all the time. Right, wrong, success, failure, lucky, unlucky, may be as limiting a way of seeing things as diabetic, epileptic, manic depressive, or even invalid. Labeling sets up an expectation of life that is often so compelling we can no longer see things as they really are. This expectation often gives us a false sense of familiarity towards something that is really new and unprecedented. We are in relationship with our expectations and not with life itself. Like a diagnosis, a label is an attempt to assert control and manage uncertainty. It may allow us the security and comfort of mental closure and encourage us not to think about things again. But life never comes to a closure. Life is a process, even mystery. Life is known only by those who have found a way to be comfortable with change and the unknown. Given the nature of life, there may be no security, but only adventure. So that spirit of, you know, labels are limiting. And probably all of us have been in the receiving end of other people's labeling us and being seen a certain way, a certain category of person or some way, and feeling how limiting it is and how it's kind of deadening in some way. Or we do it to ourselves. So we have certain labels like good and bad, which we realize after a while are not very useful labels to have for our experience. And then there are other times, to go back to the other side of life, words giving life. There's lots of situations in life where we give our word. And in our giving our word, something comes into existence that didn't exist before. And perhaps the most clear one is a ceremony of commitment, where two people get married or partner up in some way, and they give each other their word. And that word gives birth to something that wasn't there before. To make a vow. To keep one's word, to be a person of one's word, is a very high praise. You can count on that person's word. When that person says something, the person means something, means it. It's interesting, the word for faith in Chinese, you know, they have these pictures for drawing their words, pictograms, and it's the character for a man or person next to the character for a word. So a person standing next to his or her word is to have confidence or faith or some connection there. So, you know, to have faith, to stand by our words, have some relationship to words is a very important part of human life. So words can kill and words can give life. Another example of words being useful in the Buddhist tradition is with the Buddha's encounter with Mara, which is for the purposes of our talk, we can call the Buddhist devil, which is probably, Mara will complain that this is not a good label. But, you know, we just take it kind of lightly. So Mara is kind of like the Buddhist devil. And in the stories of the Buddha's life, Mara visits the Buddha various times in his life. And it's interesting the difference between how the Buddha relates to Mara before his enlightenment and after. And before his enlightenment, he has to really work hard to not succumb to the forces of temptations that Mara represents. Mara's basically inner psychological temptations and forces that keep us distracted and not present and not free. And so he has to use all his strength, his ability to stay still, not move, his patience. He has to kind of, you know, it's a real struggle. Sometimes it's called, before his enlightenment, that he had to fight. There was a war against the armies of Mara. After his enlightenment, Mara still comes to attack the Buddha or visit the Buddha. And after the Buddha's enlightenment, all the Buddha does when Mara comes is Buddha says, "I see you. Mara, I see you." And as soon as the Buddha says that, Mara runs away. And something in that short statement, "I see you," Mara, she says a name, "Mara, I see you." Naming what's there and recognizing what it is can have a power to create freedom, to free us from some of the entanglements that we get caught up in. When I do the introductory course, and maybe many of you have done it, so I apologize, but I sometimes talk about naming. Naming something is like the fairy tales of old, where if you name the dragon loses its power. And or if you go to some traditional cultures, I remember when I went to Morocco, this was the case. No, it wasn't Morocco, but anyway, if you name, sometimes you don't tell someone your birth name, because then they have some power over you. And so you have some nickname you use through your life, but you have your own birth name, which you keep close to yourself. So the idea that naming and names have power is something that is familiar to many cultures, and it's familiar to Buddhism. The words can have a lot of power in the Buddhist tradition. One of the forms of power around words is what's called a statement of truth. It's a technical word in Pali. I forget exactly what it is. But it's a ritual, a practice that goes back to the time of the Buddha and probably predates him in India, that if you make a statement that is true, intentionally, that comes with it certain power that can affect the world around you. And there's one story in the Buddha Buddha times where the Buddha tells one of his disciples who had been a murderer before he became a monk and enlightened to make a true statement to help a woman who's going through a difficult child giving birth. And to help her through help her with her birthing. And the Buddha tells him, make a statement in her presence that in your life, your whole life, you've never harmed anyone. He looks at her, Buddha says, I can't say that because I killed people. And the Buddha says, well, say what you can. So the guy says, since I was ordained as a monk, I have never harmed anybody. And that's his true statement. And he's making this true statement. And the woman gives birth nicely. So I don't know, you know, but the stories like that. But I do know that I lived on the farm in Tennessee in the 1970s. It was a hippie commune of 800 people when I was there. And the high priests of the farm were the midwives. And they had a spiritual midwifery scene that they had books, many people maybe, a very popular book for a long time. And there they would give talks. The teacher there would give talks sometimes about, he would be there helping people give birth. And this couple, the husband and wife, or the man and woman would be there. And the birth wasn't happening. And then he understood that there was some tension between the husband and wife. And he would get them kind of, you know, work it out there. And they would talk about it. And as soon as they worked it out, then the baby would come. So it sounds like a little bit of fairy tale, the stories. But those are the stories I was told. And somehow, when the truth comes out and people can say what needs to be said, that has a power in our life. So naming has power. And I've seen that in my own experience, in very kind of close by. That sometimes when I've been able to name my experience, that I sometimes can relax around it, or it relaxes. I remember the clearest time this happened was some years ago when I was feeling kind of off. And I didn't quite understand how I was feeling, but I certainly felt off enough that I went to lay down on a couch. And so I was kind of being with myself, being mindful of what was going on. And then at some point, I named it. And I named it, I was depressed. And as soon as I said, oh, it's depression, I could feel my chest relax. Because until then, my chest had been kind of, wouldn't really relax and fall back all the way. And somehow naming it and recognizing for what it was had a certain power, a certain impact that made a difference for me. So mental noting is a practice that we use in Vipassana to name our experience as it's happening. So if you're following your breath, that you're meditating, you might name the in-breath as in and the out-breath as out. If while you're doing that, a strong emotion arises, say you suddenly get really irritated, you would make a mental note in your mind, irritated, irritation. You might do that a number of times. Or the irritation or the emotion or whatever stays for a long time, you might, easygoing way, just keep up the rhythm of irritated, irritated, irritated. And just kind of name what it is. And people who get into mental noting as a continual practice will have a steady stream of noting their experience as it's happening in a very relaxed way. Kind of relaxed, calm, deliberate, kind of keeping it up. Naming what's here. And if their attention shifts in the present moment to be attention to different things, then they name different things. Hearing, itching, hearing, rising, expanding, thinking, an emotion. And you just name these things as they're occurring. Occasionally, it has the power of kind of really naming and recognizing what it's there, and you find some freedom just in clearly seeing what's happening there. Other times, it just keeps you on track. And I know for me that there are times when I think that I'm much more present as I'm meditating than I really am. I'm going along, meditating just merrily fine, And I think, you know, I'm doing pretty good here. And then I'll start in a mental noting, or I'll do something like counting the breath, and I find out, well, actually, I'm not as present as I actually thought. I needed to have the reference of the mental noting to notice how much I was actually here. And by having the continuity of the mental noting, I notice more easily when I'm falling off the present moment, when I'm not paying attention, and I have this little technique to get myself back on again and get myself going. The function of the mental noting, the primary one, is to help us stay in the present moment. So we have this little subtle thought in the back of the mind. It's like using your thinking to help you be present rather than having your thinking carry you away. And as I like to say, an idle mind gets in trouble. So if your thinking mind is idle, it'll probably wander off and get caught in something, get lost in something. But if you use the simplest possible part of the thinking mind to involve you in what's happening in the present moment, you're much more likely to stay in the present moment for longer. So you're naming what's going on. This is what's happening now. Just very simple, just simple, one word. Breathing in, out, rising, falling, hearing. Just keeping it up. Now, some people don't like to do this. Some people associate meditation with a quiet mind, and this seems to be agitating the mind to do that. It's kind of making the mind more active. People who come from other meditation experiences from before, in particular, find it very awkward to do mental noting because they're much more active in their mind than they're familiar with, and it's kind of hard to do that. But I would suggest that it's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. When you first try to learn to ride a bicycle, it's awkward. And if you simply stop riding the bicycle because the learning process was awkward, you never learn to ride your bicycle without using your hands. But it's possible to be so good at riding a bicycle, look, you don't use your hands, right? And you just lift your hands up and you go merrily along your way. And it's really easy after a while. Well, the same thing with the mental noting. If you get into it and take the time to get over the awkward stage, you might find that it actually kind of keeps you rolling along just beautifully. And after a while, it's almost as if you can let go of a certain kind of effort, like you let go of the hands from the handlebar. And it's kind of can give you kind of a release from a certain kind of way of being involved all the time. And you learn to do it really well. Mental noting has other functions. One function of it is it can give you a clue about how you're relating to your experiencing as it's happening. So if, for example, you're sitting here and you have physical pain, and your mental note is pain, 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 you know, it's kind of, you know, you're kind of like bending under the burden of it and full of aversion. That sometimes can be, you can hear that in the inner voice that's making the note, pain, pain. There's a big difference between just saying pain in some great, horrible way in your mind, or really tight, versus in a very relaxed way saying pain. Pain is what's happening, pain. Same thing with pleasure. You have a great pleasure in your meditation, and you say, ah, pleasure. If you listen to your inner voice, you get a sense that there's something extra going on there. There's a little bit of a kind of leaning into it or holding on to that, as opposed to just noting it matter-of-factly, pleasure. Pleasure is happening. And it's that kind of easygoing, kind of balanced meeting or experience that we're trying to find with mindfulness. Not being for anything, not being against anything. Just here for it in some simple way. Sometimes the mental noting functions as a nudge or kind of like a signpost pointing you in the direction of where it's useful to pay attention to. So it might be easy to slip off. Say you're with some experience, maybe an emotion or maybe a physical sensation, and you feel like this is really the place you need to pay attention in the present moment, but the mind keeps slipping off and going someplace else. And keeping up the mental noting is a nudge or encouragement. Stay there. Stay there. Stay with there. Pay attention there. Be there. Some people refer to the mental noting as creating a little frame around your experience, and saying, this is where you pay attention, within this frame. It's often said that when you do mental noting, the technique, that 95% of what you're doing is sensing or feeling or watching your experience. And 5% of what you're doing, of your effort, is in the noting itself. And that proportion is very important to remember, because people often get into the mental noting too enthusiastically. Sometimes you have the sledgehammer approach to noting, where you kind of noting is really loud and determined. You're going to crush that thing, to get rid of it, and you're going to just name it, and just, bah, pain. And there's so much effort there. Or some people get so caught up in their mental noting and figuring out the right name, and just what meditation becomes, just becomes mental noting, and just gets in the way of really being with the experiences that actually is. 95% of the experience or the effort is trying to be with the experiences that actually is. And the note is something very soft. Kind of use the softest part of your mind that you can imagine. So maybe you have the experience of having a wonderful nap, being really relaxed, everything's going well in your life, the sun is shining, you're laying out in some beautiful pastoral meadow, I don't know what. And you wake up from your wonderful little nap, and the mind is so serene and quiet, and just little wisps of thoughts go through, and just so nice. And then other times, when you're really agitated and preoccupied, and just like your thoughts seem like sledgehammers in there, kind of just pounding away, and just you're begging them to leave you alone. It feels like you're being assaulted by your thoughts. The mental noting, try to do the noting from that quiet place. The quietest place of thinking that's available to you, if you have some sense of how to note from. So it's very soft. So to encourage you that most of what you're doing is trying to feel the experience as it's actually happening. Here are some examples of people using mental noting. And this is not in a meditative situation so much, but someone who's taken the mental noting from this Vipassana practice we do, and applied it in a clinical setting, psychological setting. So this is a few examples. In one case, a divorced woman would have bouts of depression and anxiety when she remembered her ex-husband's bizarre sexual demands. She was trained to label her thoughts as remembering. And within a few days, she could see the causal relationship between thoughts and the anxiety and depression. It's pretty good. Another woman who was hospitalized for manic depression and schizophrenia was instructed to watch the second hand of a clock, and when her mind went off the clock, to name the distraction. Soon she realized that most of her distractions were related to the past. She was then instructed to label them as remembering. With this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts instead of the depressed thinker. Soon she began to gain insight into the nature of her illness and was released from hospital. Another woman who was hospitalized for anxiety, depression, and inability to function adequately rebelled against any suggestion of introspection. And as she was a Mormon, the word Buddhist or meditation was not mentioned. As the therapist interacted with her, it became evident that much of her day was spent fantasizing and imagining to avoid the anxiety of her life. The habit of fantasizing was discussed with her, and then she was asked to undertake a psychological procedure. To her surprise, she was asked to bake a cake. However, she had to do it extremely mindfully, with minute attention to detail. When the persistent fantasies would arise, she was instructed to just observe them. After a while, she found that she could intentionally return to the present moment and so function more adequately. She also began to gain insight into the nature of her anxiety and depression. Well, the last example, she's not using the mental noting, but the first two examples of people using these noting. And partly, you start seeing the patterns more clearly of what's happening in your mind if you're noting them. It's kind of like a little, you notice after a while, you keep saying remembering or planning. And sometimes it's hard to know that you realize you're planning all the time. But if you say planning, after a while, you kind of, notice after a few weeks or something that this is a common theme. And learning the common themes of your mind is actually a very useful aspect of meditation, because then you're less likely to be caught by those themes if you've learned to see them and recognize them and learn to work with them or interested in working with them as they come along. The principle with mental noting is a principle, is it helpful, the mental noting, for getting you closer to the experience, more mindful, more in the present moment? Is it helpful for you to be more intimate with your experience? Is it helpful for you to help the mind become stiller, quieter? The mind can be very, very quiet, and still you can do the mental noting. It's possible to do that. If it's not doing that for you, if mental noting is making you more agitated, then either you're going through a transition phase where you're learning how to do it, or perhaps it's not for you, or you shouldn't be doing it at that point. I know some people will do mental noting throughout their practice, and I don't use it as much as I used to, but all of my deep practice in Vipassana, long retreats that I did, I use mental noting all the time. It was a practice that I used. It was very important for me for the whole length of my career practice. Other people I know find it very useful at certain phases of practice. They find it very useful when they first start out, when the mind is still somewhat coarse. And as the mind gets more refined and you get more concentrated, then people will stop doing the mental noting. One of the places I find the noting very helpful for me now, it's not exactly naming the experience, but I find if I sit down to meditate and my mind is agitated and it's hard for me to be in the present moment, then I'll say the note to myself, here. Not like a command like you would to a dog, but just kind of like here, here. And I just kind of say it in an easygoing way, and just a reminder that here I am. It's not telling myself to be here. I'm just a reminder, here I am. Here I am as a person who's distracted. Here is a person who's distracted. This is what it's like to be a person who's distracted. And I'm not trying to stop being distracted, but just, this is what it's like. Of course, you are in the present moment if you're recognizing yourself distracted in the present moment, right? And that's all we're being asked to do, is to recognize distraction as it's happening. So I find it very helpful. So I do that for a while, and then after a few minutes, I find myself much more present, and then it's much easier to continue with the meditation being in the present moment. Some people will only use mental noting for noting their breath. If the breath is the anchor of the meditation practice, they note their breath, in, out, or rising, falling. But other things that arise in the meditation, they might not note them, but they use the breath. They find that it creates kind of like a tether between the awareness and the breath to have that noting there. So they can do the noting for the breath. Other people I know will only note thoughts or thinking. We'll have silent meditation for everything else. But when the mind wanders off in thought or as thought bubbles up, they know, oh, thinking. And that's a great help for them for not getting caught in their thoughts, to create a little bit of freedom from their thoughts, a little bit of distance, so they're not entangled in their thoughts. And probably a few of you occasionally know the difficulty of getting entangled in thoughts, how it might happen. I know some people, so there's different ways of doing it, and I think the encouragement is that to find your own way and feel free to be playful about it or to be creative about how to use mental noting. Don't have this kind of tight idea that there's a technique, there's a right, perfect way of doing it, and you're going to get all kind of, you know, tied up in a knot doing it. Be really relaxed about how you do it, and try to do it in a way that kind of is, in a relaxed way, kind of is helpful for you and keeps you going, keeps you getting closer, more intimate, more stiller in the practice, rather than the opposite. It's a beautiful thing because it kind of helps join together the mind and our experience, the mind and the body. If you're noting your breath or noting your bodily experiences or your emotions in your body, you're kind of like the mind, which is noting, is kind of joined together, is there with the body. A huge part of mindfulness practice is being embodied, but not embodied divorced from your mind, but embodied where there's kind of a joining together of the mind and the body. So the two are operating the same place at the same time, working in concert. Um, Sometimes it's helpful to note exactly what's there. Sometimes if you know with precision, as best you can, what is actually happening, it's more freeing, more disentangling. Like for me, my little depression I described, if I just continued noting feeling off, that wasn't enough to kind of free somehow my chest from what was going on. But when I saw it for what it was, for depression, then it released. Part of the problem of that, of what I just said, though, is that then people will get spend a lot of time thinking about the right label in meditation. And that's not really meditation if you're thinking about, you know, trying to figure out and trying out different things, like trying out different shoes. Is that the right label? Is that the right label? If it's not an obvious, easy label, then don't try figuring out what the right label is. Just what's obvious, what's easiest. And then as you stay present for it, it might get revealed to you what a more precise label is. But don't, you know, be ahead of yourself. Just kind of be relaxed about it. And sometimes if you have no idea what's going on, but you know something is going on, you can just label going on. Or you can just label having an experience, which is a very California thing to do. And just experience. And then as you're present for that experience, you can just get closer. One of the great kind of umbrella labels for your experience that I've used sometimes is chaos. And that just covers everything. And then I'm there with that, what that's like for a while. And after a while, it gets revealed to me with more details of what's going on in chaos. Another label that I've used at times, I've mostly used this when my practice is actually going quite strong and I'm very concentrated. Rather than naming the experience for what it is, I still find it useful to have a kind of label that kind of keeps me focused, keeps me on track, keeps me going. It's kind of, and the label I've used sometimes is the word yes. It's kind of nice, you know, just say yes to everything. Yes, 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 yes. And sometimes my mind is very still and very concentrated. The mental label, if you can call it that I use, has regressed maybe to my 14-month-old stage. And I just go, Just very good. And I just kind of grunt at the experience. And that just little grunt kind of keeps me connected, keeps me concentrated, keeps me kind of going into the practice further. And anything more complicated kind of ruffles the territory. But just kind of a little subtle grunt. Grunt meditation. So there's all kinds of ways of doing it. So I encourage you to be playful and imaginative in doing it. Do you have any questions or comments about this technique?
I found that to be very helpful because I had thought that labeling meant that you had to name your mental experience, which is far too involved for me to do. But I can see why it would be helpful to simply say this is there, that is there, that is there.
Yeah.
I can see where that would help. So,
yes, and so it's a very simple label. It's like if you're sitting here and you hear some noise, you know, suddenly a whole bunch of people walk into the hall, a mental label would not be, a lot of people are walking in the hall, and they're walking in really noisy, and how could they? That is not a mental note. The kind of mental note of this technique is simply, hearing footsteps, or just hearing. That simple. You keep it that simple, hearing footsteps. Or if you do get irritated, all these people marching in, you would say, you would note, irritated. The note is not meant to be a judgment. It's meant to be very neutral, simple, the simplest kind of recognition in the present moment, this is what's happening. Other questions? Reservations? Yes?
I just have a comment that noting is a wonderful tool for dealing with reactive mind.
Mm-hmm.
In day-to-day life, it's the best tool. To break that pattern of reactive mind by noting.
And develop a habit of noting, to note before you speak. Yes?
People who have problems with words or labeling, like you were talking about earlier, and
Yeah, sometimes it's freeing. There's a little saying that's quite used quite a bit in our circles that comes from an Indian Vipassana teacher who said, your thoughts of your mother is not your mother. And when he said that to someone, it freed her. And it's... There are some people who use mental noting as a security blanket. And I know a couple of individuals who really got into mental noting, and they used it as, I don't think it was very healthy this way. They used it because they felt that they're, maybe it was okay. I don't know them well enough, so maybe given who they were, maybe it was very wise. But what they were doing, they were so afraid of their mind and their thoughts being out of control and being painful that they had like a mantra, ongoing mental noting of what was going on all the time, kept thinking, so they wouldn't have to face themselves. So that's not, you know, normally that's not what's meant in this practice. The mental noting is to free us to be really present here and find the freedom with what's happening rather than be entangled by it.
What's the difference between mental noting and observing?
Observing doesn't require any noting. Doesn't require any mental movement of the mind where it clearly names or labels the experience. So it's kind of it's so, and so Vipassana practice, mindfulness practice can function quite well with only non-discursive awareness, just or observation, just seeing for what it is. So we can see and we can feel and sense a lot of things without even thinking about it or naming it, but then we give it a name. And in a sense, maybe this is important to say that. To make the mental noting as simple as possible means we want to stay with naming the primary way in which we're experiencing something. So we don't necessarily note the dog barking, but just note hearing is happening. That's the simple, just hearing, and then you hear that more carefully. Or so we're not labeling the experience out there. We're not objectifying the experience, which is often the problem with labeling in real life sometimes, right? But we're more like, oh, hearing is happening now. Seeing is happening now. Walking is happening now. Movement in my body is happening now. As opposed to something which is, you know, one step removed, which is, you know, kind of overarching label of what that experience is. Does that make sense, what I just said? So kind of keep it at the sensory level, level of sensations or... Yes, Gerald.
As you were talking, I remember some of my experiences around recognitions from a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's as if it seems to be a level just below some noting. It's as if whatever my attention and awareness landed on something that was pleasant or unpleasant, then really only to be able to recognize that it's, you know, dark or barking.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it feels like a little bit lower level of awareness.
Deeper level, more fundamental,
yeah.
The pleasant, unpleasant aspect of it. Yeah.
It's almost like the reaction starts, and then the name forms.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
Right. Step back, but under.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And in fact, when the mindfulness practice is quite strong, you might be aware of hearing like a dog, but you don't. Your mind actually doesn't cognize it as a dog barking. It's just sound. You feel the vibration coming. And it doesn't go to that next step of identifying it as a dog.
Yeah. And you might register as unpleasant.
Yeah.
First.
Yeah.
And then find it.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
So my hope is that some of you will try it if you haven't tried it before. And hopefully you'll find it useful. And over time, you'll find how it's useful for you. It's different. It's useful in different ways for different people. Joseph Goldstein once told me that it was his impression that meditators who use the technique of mental noting tend, as a group, statistically, right, with a margin of error of 3%, to make faster progress in meditation than those people who don't. Now, that doesn't mean everyone. Some people who don't note make good progress and whatever. And then also that brings the question, what do you mean by progress? And, which is a whole dangerous topic in itself. But his experience of being a teacher for almost 30 years has been that this is actually a very helpful technique for people. So thank you, and welcome back to the enlightening part of our year. May this new part of the year, that as the sun comes back, bring much light and joy and happiness to you and your friends and community. Thank you.